Okay, good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? Okay, so some people think Rochester, Minnesota is circumpolar. So I'm actually going to be going back and talking about some of the work that I did at the Mayo Clinic before moving to UCSF recently. And the title of my talk is Creating Ongoing Community-Based Governance for Health Research Using Fully Identifiable Medical Records. Okay, I have nothing to disclose. And what I'm going to be talking about today is called the Rochester Epidemiology Project. How many of you have heard of the REP already? A few. So if you haven't, the REP is one of the unique resources in American epidemiology in that the REP is one of the only places in the U.S. where you can do population research, population-based research, and I'm going to tell you a bit more about it. So indeed, what I'm going to do is start by telling you a bit more about the REP. For those of you who don't know it, apologies to those who do. Then I'm going to describe a community engagement we conducted in Minnesota using techniques of what are called deliberative democracy, which is quite a bit different than the CBPR sorts of approaches that we just were talking about in the last talk. Then I'm going to talk about how that community engagement activity we got advice and we created a community advisory board, and that community advisory board then becomes an opportunity to get community members to provide adaptive governance of a unique research resource, which is the Rochester Epidemiology Project. And I'm going to argue throughout that what we're showing is some progress in creating meaningful ethical, quote-unquote, governance of this unique research resource. So what is the REP? Well, first of all, it's a big research infrastructure, and it's very unique. It links together the medical records of everyone in Olmsted County, Minnesota, from multiple sources, so not just from a single institution, so very different. It facilitates access to medical records, and it has a huge historical archive, in some cases back into the early parts of the 20th century. It enables population-based research, and for those of you in public health, you know that having the denominator is absolutely critical for answering many questions. And this is a unique resource in that it's been funded by NIH for literally almost 50 years. I can think of very few things that have been. A little bit under duress now, as we all are, but there we go. One of the reasons it's unique is because researchers have this access to the medical record, but the work is essentially unconsented, meaning that there's no formal consent process. So researchers, once approved, have full access to medical records. And the records are not de-identified. The information is not de-identified, so it's a very different kinds of things. This resource has produced thousands of publications on many, many very important questions. And one of the reasons we did the community engagement that I'm about to describe is because there were plans to extend the REP methodology through all of southeastern Minnesota. Okay. In terms of the history, one of the reasons this is an interesting experiment because Minnesota, those of you who know state privacy laws, knows that Minnesota is unusual in actually having a requirement for authorization. Think about the distinction between consent and authorization. So HIPAA provides authorization, for example. So this is authorization. And there is a requirement for authorization that is usually obtained via an opt-out method, which I can tell you more about, but those of you, I think we're all in bioethics here, so you know what I mean by that. Essentially, there's no requirement to actively opt in, but if you don't opt out, you get in this database. The last major community engagement that was done with the community was in 1996, and that was when a new medical privacy law passed in Minnesota requiring authorization before records could be used. And Mayo Clinic and its partners actually went back and wrote to everybody in the area, which was a huge undertaking. But then in general, those of you recognize the ostrich with its head in the ground, but Mayo and the other partners in the area and the REP were really no different than other groups in that throughout most of the 50-year REP history, the way of dealing with these issues of community engagement has been to sort of put their head in the sand on the assumption that hopefully no one will see what we're doing. When the last round of the REP was funded, we decided to really totally change tack. I was brought on as a consultant and senior member of the scientific board, and we decided to change that and figure out a new way of doing community governance. And so you think about it, why did we do that? Well, the background is a rapidly changing research environment. all of the new requirements for meaningful use, the High Tech Act, for those of you who know that, you know, increasing use of electronic medical records for secondary purposes, just the general big data move, and then accompanying that, not to mention Snowden and the National Security Association, et cetera, we see increased social concerns about privacy and confidentiality generally. So it was pretty clear to us that the rep couldn't proceed with business as usual, that we needed to change. So just a few slides that my rep colleagues provided me to give you a sense of the scope of this. So it has 1.8 million patient records. The data come from 50 different kinds of providers, including dentists, all of the healthcare providers, clinicians, et cetera. We have someone in the room who probably, Patricia, who's probably, his patients are probably members of the rep. Almost a million unique individuals with multiple medical records. So another reason that's unique is that it gives you a complete picture of all the healthcare delivered to a single individual. So this is an example from John Smith, Olmsted County resident, and you can see in the way that in 1994, he had these three events, one that happened at Olmsted Medical Center, one in the Mayo Emergency Room, and one in the Olmsted Medical Center. And using the rep, you can actually capture all of that and look at people longitudinally, which is why it's unique. It also includes a census of the county. That's how we get the denominator, about 500,000 people. And again, the goal, I won't go through all the details because it's such a complicated bioinformatics enterprise, but it really is we can actually enumerate the residents at any given point in time, and we can actually go back and figure out when people were living in Rochester, which I won't say more about. But again, it's based on this idea of the focus on the person, the link via the person. And so you see the person over there linked to all of these different sources of their data, their records. And then you can look at the different visits over time in the different places, and you can literally follow all of them. So each of the medical visits are discrete, many different encounters, and 1.2 million medical records. So it's a huge undertaking, even just within Olmsted County. It allows work over the lifespan, from birth literally to death. And for those of you who are more interested, in this, you go to rochesterproject.org and you can see many of the thousands of very important publications. And more recently, the REF, because of the Affordable Care Act and other things, is going into even more basic kinds of research. I'll say a little bit more about that. But just to remind you again why this is unique, it's not a de-identified data set, which is what we usually rely on to protect confidentiality. Rather, it's a linkage system. So when a researcher is approved to get access, they literally can go and sit in a room, get links, and review people's actual records. So very unique, and it includes demographic information, diagnostic codes and dates, surgical codes and dates, prescription codes and dates. And I'll just give you two examples of recent papers recent data sets. One is a paper that got a lot of play of the 10 top conditions that occurred in this county, because it's, one of the only places where you can do that in the U.S. And this shows that the top disorder that people were complaining of were skin disorders, joint disorders, back problems, et cetera. So very different than what you might see if you look at another metric. And finally, there was another paper that got a lot of play recently that showed the 10 most commonly prescribed drug groups in the 2009 population. So you can see lots of different, and we have, it's unusual to have drug records that are this complete for a population. You can see the antidepressants way up there at the top. Even in Minnesota, where you think everyone would be, well, maybe they're not happy because of the snow. We were just talking about that. Back to the circumpolar. Okay. So the summary, you can look at all these different things, but again, think of what people are giving up to make that data available, and do they understand it, and cost data are available. So that's another way in which it's a unique resource, because these organizations that supply data have agreed to not compete, and they don't share that kind of data, but you can actually study what things really cost, not what they're charged, which is unique. Okay. So turning to this community engagement exercise, which I worked on and helped design, And in starting in 2010, when the most recent five-year grant was renewed, we decided to plan for an expansion of the REP and to deal with these unique issues like the identifiability of data and the research authorization law. So the way that the research authorization law works for use of medical records, and I'll use Mayo Clinic as an example, Mayo Clinic sends you, if you're a new patient, a description of what work with what research with medical records looks like, and then you're given two different opportunities to opt in or opt. You can positively opt in, but if you don't opt out, you then become part of the database. So that's the bottom line. So that's then the process that we were engaging with the community about. So in the summer of 2011, to get ready for this, we did a representative sample of residents, and only a third had even heard of this resource. So very few, and that was probably higher because it probably was more filled out by people who were knowledgeable. And so what we then did was something called a deliberative democracy, or what I call a deliberative community engagement. And we conducted this in November 2011. I could spend 3 hours just talking about what it is to put one of these events together. I always joke it's like having a wedding, a bar mitzvah, and an academic conference all in the same at the same time in terms of the people doing the organization. But we do these in an intensive four-day engagement over two weekends. You create an elaborate briefing book with intensive education. I'm happy to share that with people. It's professionally facilitated. You have small and large group discussions. So people deliberate and come to conclusions in a briefing book with intensive education. I'm happy to share that with people. It's we use some audience response technology to really get a sense of how people were making trade-offs among different kinds of values. And we also we pay people well. So these are expensive enterprises. They're not cheap. A couple objectives. First is, you know, if you ask people how much they value their privacy, they all make motherhood and apple pie responses. Oh, yes, privacy, great thing, let's have it. If you ask people how much privacy they're willing to trade off for other health benefits, then the conversation is quite different. So the point of these discussions was to really get people in small groups, once they were very educated with the briefing book and hearing from experts, to make those trade-offs, and then hopefully to develop some consensus, but not to force anyone to agreement, because indeed one of the main purposes of these deliberative approaches is to identify areas of persistent disagreement on the theory that that's just as useful information. And I want to thank my colleague Michael Burgess at UBC, who I worked with in developing this technique. So in terms of recruitment, so we don't find a pre-existing community out there. Rather, we use the whole county. We selected at random from the county using a set of criteria, an age range stated there, 20 to 70. We slightly oversampled for minority race because of the composition of Olmsted, which is more diverse than you probably would think, but not as diverse as other parts of the country. We tried to have a range in the room of education, occupation. We didn't want too many healthcare providers, and also we looked at people who were rural or urban, and then we had slots, and we sort of created an ideal group of deliberants based on those characteristics. So now, I could tell you a lot more about that process. It's really, really fascinating, and we sort of record everything and are able to do a lot of in-depth qualitative analysis then later to see what actually happens in the encounters. But today, I wanted, often, you can do one of these exercises, but how do you then make sure that it actually does something? How does it do something in the world? Does it actually get translated into policy, which is the key issue? So in this case, we were actually able to do that because after we finished this, we were actually able to create a community advisory board based on the recommendations of the deliberation. But before I talk about what the CAB, which we call it, the Community Advisory Board, does, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what the deliberants were interested in. So we start out by getting people to talk generally about their hopes and concerns for a particular area of research. And in this case, there was a lot of optimism. You know, people are smart, and when you explain to them how a database like this works, they're very interested. And the fact that it allows, this kind of unique longitudinal research. And then there were three themes that came up in terms of people's hope, for the Rochester Epidemiology Project. Hope that there could be transparency, more transparency, through educating the community and communicating with the community, because most of the deliberants had never heard, like the community members, had never heard of this. They thought it was good and that it should grow more because they saw its value, but they wanted to have a little more involvement, and they wanted the leaders of the REP, which is this interdisciplinary group, to do that. There were concerns, and the basic themes were data safety, misuse, and privacy. Lots of discussion about different potential misuses, some of them local, like what if your neighbor was the one reviewing your record? There were some concerns about the research authorization process. They understood that what the process that we were using was legal, but they actually made an interesting discussion, but was it really ethical? We met the law, but was that ethical? And then there was a lot of concern about how too much regulation would compromise the efficiency of this resource for researchers. And so that was one of the trade-offs that people talked about. So very interesting. I'm now going to talk to you a little bit more about the deliberative outputs, which is based on weighing these hopes and concerns for this kind of research. How did people, what were the final conclusions that people agreed to as a group, thinking for the whole county, not just for themselves? And they did that thinking about privacy and confidentiality, study recruitment procedures, because you can know, like a database like this, some research is purely passive, but sometimes the REP is actually used to invite people to be part of specific studies. And then they, the other thing that people wanted to talk about a lot was what kind of communication process the REP should use with the community, and what role should the community play in governance, so those areas. The overarching conclusion, and this is very interesting, it took a lot of debate and discussion and voting on different phrasing. The deliberants were satisfied with the REP's opt-out research authorization process and considered these ethical as long as, so they don't consider them ethical now, but they said if we make these two changes, they would consider it to be ethical. First, that the REP improved its community education and essentially its transparency, because they thought this was critical. So this is very important. They were saying what you're doing now isn't ethical unless you change this. So do more community education. And then they also advised forming a community advisory body to assure citizens' voice in governing the REP. Although there were even a couple persistent disagreements about that, because some people thought, well, it's so clear that you're trustworthy that we don't need to do that. I don't know if I believe that, but that's but there were disagreements even about that. Okay, so then as the next step, the deliberants created this set of recommendations, which we brought back to the REP leadership, and then the REP then sent responses back on each of the points. And I'll just quickly tell you a little bit, because obviously in some cases you can't necessarily do everything that the community wants. Okay, so I just said the current REP recruitment practices were good, but they can be improved. On the recommendation about improved community outreach and education, the leadership said, yes, that's not a problem, and I'll say more later about how we're working on that. Include more REP-specific information with written recruitment materials. Okay, this was a really interesting point. The community members were very concerned that every group had their own way of describing this and that no one really talked about the Rochester Epidemiology Project specifically. They talked about medical records research generally, because that's the way the opt-out worked. It was just, is it okay to use your medical records for research? Well, that's very different than this intensive database that is the REP, and so there was some concern about that. So the community wanted more uniformity in materials, that may be hard to do because all the individual clinics that are part of this, of course, want to have their own control of what materials that they do look like. So we're going to strive for that, but it's different, and we explain that to the community members. Again, this opt-in, opt-out is so important. On the current opt-out practice, it is fine. A small minority, though, until the very end, did prefer opt-in, and the people discussed that with a lot of mutual respect. And then the community, and this is also important, one of the things that's happened over the years is the percentage of people who end up in the REP database who are there through an opt-out mechanism as opposed to actually having opted in is growing, and it tends to be people who are younger, don't speak English, and have different, and so the community members were very sensitive to this, and they wanted us to make a special effort to make sure that there was more justice in the way people get into this database by making sure that that we had targeted different communities in a particular way. I'm going to skip. How am I doing? 1 minute? Okay. Then I'm going to skip reauthorization. So the key messages are that they want us to communicate the REP exists, the medical record data are probably in the REP, a lot has been learned from the REP, and the REP agrees we'll work with community advisors to implement. So we clearly are doing that. They also recommended that we educate frontline healthcare workers about the REP. That's already happened. I think not quite as much as Mayo, Patricio, but it is happening at OMC, in which all the desk staff have been educated about what this is so that if patients have questions, they can answer. And I'm going to skip that one, too. That's because that's about more traditional research where you actually invite people in to have a blood draw, so it's less quite different. So the final recommendation was for the creation of the Community Advisory Board, and that board was formed with a core group of deliberants. About half the people who were selected at random agreed to participate in the ongoing board. We got some additional participants from people who'd been part of another project that I ran about EMR use, and then we also got some assistance from our Clinical and Translational Science Institute community group. It has about 20 members. We started by orienting everyone to get them up to speed, and it has quarterly meetings, and I fly back to Rochester to be part of these meetings. And then this is very important. It's actually led by a community member who was elected by in this case, his peers. We've done a lot of things to try and get it up and running. This is just a screenshot of something that we're pilot testing now. We have created something at the deliberate suggestion called the CAB Corner, which is the Community Advisory Board corner on our website. So they can actually look at all the agendas, materials, share information with each other. They've actually formed into a series of work groups, and they've set priorities about which things they want to do first in terms of how to educate our community. And just to give you one example, they did a lot of brainstorming at meetings. You don't have to read this, but this is just to give you a sense of how engaged people are. So this is a two-page list of ideas of where they're willing to go out to do presentations and to interact with the community. They actually worked together and created a big poster that they can take out to county fairs and things like that in the area to tell people about the REP and actually become essentially to describe this whole process. So that poster is probably hard to read, but this was created specifically for a women's health fair, so it has a lot of examples from women's health. Okay, so this whole enterprise, I would say, I work with Mike Burgess and Kieran O'Doherty from, who's both are Canadian, and we think about this whole approach as trying to think of governance of research using a model based on adaptive governance, and this is in contrast to models based more specifically on informed consent, where you essentially have a contract model with people ahead of time, which then has very little flexibility, and sometimes you run into trouble later. So I think that what we've created is a good example of that kind of adaptive governance. It allows us to look at new problems as they develop, for example, things like the changing privacy environment, which is changing very dramatically. We now have new HIPAA privacy rules. How should we think about that? We also are in a situation where there's a changing boundary between research and clinical care. The Affordable Care Act is bringing that to the fore, all the efforts to mine electronic records, and the new forms of patient engagement promoted by new efforts like PCORI. And so actually our community advisory board is now advising us on how to actually implement some of the requirements of things like PCORI. So very interesting. Okay, so I just have three conclusion slides. Am I okay? Okay, so in conclusion, I think the REP Community Advisory Board provides ongoing guidance to the REP leadership, building on and enhancing a state-mandated medical records research authorization process. So I think we have actually managed to figure out how to engage with the community. A community governance model can be an ethically robust alternative to individual patient control of access to medical records for population health research. Now, in a way, we have a floor in Minnesota of the law, but we think we've gone beyond the floor provided by that authorization law. A community governance model can be built on the foundation of a deliberative democracy process, reflecting diverse perspectives drawn from a demographically stratified sample of citizens. So I want to end by thanking my co-authors and collaborators, and also the whole REP team and the biomedical ethics research team at Mayo. And I'm very open to taking any quick questions before we move on. Thanks very much.